Welcome, everyone. Welcome back to the next episode of Baltimore Real Estate Full Circle. I am very happy and privileged to have Avram Forman on the ear with us. And Avram, before I really jump into anything, who are you? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. I appreciate that. Quick story of my life. I grew up in Toronto. I developed a lot of my morals from there and from my father in particular. Came to the United States, got married here, lived in Queens for a while, and worked at a Fortune 500 company called IDT. A lot of Jews that were there. It was a good place to get started. I had my MBA stayed there for about 10 years. Left there, went into multifamily real estate in New York and New Jersey as an owner, as a property manager. I wish I could tell you that my successes there were, all that they were cracked up to be, but I'm sure all the listeners will also appreciate how hard real estate is. From the outside, it just seems like all gold and silver, but can oftentimes be very difficult. And I realized that my skill set is more on the back office type of things, analytical and salesy, but not necessarily the skills necessary for running a property itself. I'll add that it probably wasn't the best time to buy. It was right by the last recession. So I was buying at 80, 90 a door. And then, about 6 months later, they're worth about 30, 40 a door. It did all, of course, come back and, start selling for 150, 160 a door. And if I would have waited it out, it would have been fine. But it was a tough time. Banks were really putting a lot of pressure on us. That led me back to, in short, to a brokerage firm where I did, I was a CEO of a large mortgage broker company, which ultimately led me to Greystone. And I started in management, but switched about 10 years ago into sales, and it's probably the best decision I made in my life. So I think it's a combination of a lot of the historical different things that give me a unique perspective on working with my clients that other people don't have. As my former boss said to me, he goes, there's plenty of people who know real estate, but don't understand the business. There's plenty of people who know business, but don't know real estate. I'm privileged, and I should put me in a position where I have both.
Beautiful. I really appreciate the rundown, and I'm going to go back to the beginning. What took you, well, first of all, after leaving Toronto, going to New York, why real estate?
I don't know. Seemed like the thing that everyone else was doing. And again, had I stayed with it and I would have had the right partners, everything's a learning lesson in life. So the mistake I made, which probably, again, goes back to my Canadian roots, is that I was very naive and trusting of people. And the most important thing, advice I could give anyone about real estate is it's not the deal that you buy. It's not the location. It's not the class. It's not whether it's a primary market or secondary or tertiary. It's who you're doing business with. Whether that's an investment sales broker like yourself, or your partners, or the people that you're contracting with, it's who you're partnering with and doing stuff with that's the most important for success, and then everything else can be kind of worked out. As long as you become a specialist, you're great at C properties or B properties, whatever it is, but there is nothing to overcome when your partners or the people you're working with are not in the same pace as you, or they can't be trusted.
Right. So you went from IBT, you started your own firm. What assets did you focus on? What class? What, it was a retail, industrial, multifamily?
Multifamily. The reason I stuck with multifamily is because I kind of, I like to read and I like to learn from others. So I kind of follow the Warren Buffett model, which is do something that is there during good times and bad, which is multifamily. May not be as sexy as some of the other or have as much as a upside, but it's very solid. It's very easy to understand. If things get better, so you have tenants who are making more money, they move out and they get replaced by somebody else who's paying more, and same vice versa if there's a decline. So I just focused on that, mostly in Newark, East Orange, and Irvington in New Jersey. I also bought in Westchester in New York. It was all small properties, I would say, between, let's say, 8 and 25 units. Again, if I was doing it all over again and I was going back in, I would tell most of my clients the same thing. It's almost the same amount of work, to buy a 10-unit building as it is to buy a 100-unit building. But on the back end, it's so much easier. If you have a few tenants that move out on a large building, you can manage through tougher times. So you have one tenant moves out on a 10-unit building, you have a much bigger issue. So again, each to each their own. You got to find what works best for you. But that was what the biggest, one of the biggest things I learned from the last time.
Right, which is funny, which is also why I got into multifamily brokerage, because I came from management, then I went into portfolio sales of single families. And what I learned doing just here and there some single family non-portfolio sales is that the work I put into some of these single family sales equaled the same amount of work I put into some of these portfolio sales, yet the payout was obviously a lot more in the single family portfolios versus just some one-off. And right away, I realized that I might as well put the work into something bigger that pays out more if the work is essentially the same work. The only difference really is truly understanding the asset. Like you said, multifamily is not that hard to understand, but you know, it's even easier, just a single family house that you're selling to a homeowner. So I think a lot of people play in that space because I don't know if they're ready or comfortable to jump to the next step, or if there is as much units out there, so there's that lack of certainty. But getting back to your first point about the, I guess you could say, the failures of going into some, you know, more of a spread out portfolio with 20 units here, probably 5 units here, 10 units there. And I'm gonna jump into an assumption that when you started picking these up, with obviously the market becoming tighter, the biggest issue to fail would probably be the actual performance, which, and correct me if I'm wrong, because it was scattered, your cost ratio probably increased more than you thought, which eventually meant you needed to sell, but then you couldn't. Like, what happened there that you got to the point where you're like, okay, I'm gonna cut my losses and go into, you know, debt brokerage?
All right. So first of all, there's just sort of the back part. I didn't necessarily think I was going to go into debt brokerage. That just happened to be the next opportunity that came my way.
Got
And
it.
as I said, the group that I joined, which was some very good years that I, made a lot of friends. And it's a space that I think that there's actually a lot of talented people, a lot of people that are, I can relate to. But that was just happened to be the next opportunity that came my way. That I could say that I purposely decided to go there is probably not 100% accurate. Look, I think it's about a personality. So it's not so much that you can't make money. I think all things are different. So for example, you mentioned, individual homes. I think that if you're doing individual homes, single homes in the right way, you can make a lot more money. You could buy a house for $250,000 in a small market, do a bunch of repairs. And then you could, if they time the market right, you could sell it for five, six, $700,000, and you're making a lot more money. But it's a lot more work, right? It's a totally different type of thing than buying lots of what I did, lots of multifamilies in the small, mid-size range. I think you have to find what works for you. This is true about anything in life. You have to do something that you enjoy and that meets your particular types of skill set. What I'm saying for myself that I learned is that if I would have owned a 100-unit building, as an example, or even a 50-unit building, and there was a super in that building that maybe wouldn't be doing as good of a job as I could do, not knocking on the doors nearly as much as I would, not being as forceful as I would, but it would give me the opportunity to buy something else or focus on something that was more valuable for my time, that would have been better than me running around to all different types of properties. I personally today have some clients that own dozens, 40, 50, 60, 70 properties that are in this small range, and they are a well-oiled machine and they do extremely well. They're large enough that they can have different groups of people that are focused on different things, and it works for them. You have to be willing, we all have ADD, so it's okay to do that multiple things at the same time. But the question is, do you want to keep buying small little stuff and do another
Correct.
transaction? Or would you rather buy a 100, 200 unit building, a 500 unit building, and say, this is my project for the next 2 years, and I'm going to, take it from a B minus to a B plus or whatever it is that your objective is?
Right. And I think to your point, a lot of times, and I'm unfortunately, and we'll get into this with the market that I'm in Baltimore, a lot of times ownership groups that are buying these smaller assets, you know, let's say anywhere from $1 to $6 million of value, They're typically going to give it to a third-party manager, and they're going to assume that the manager is going to do a very good job, which, listen, a lot of cases they do. But what I realize is that you need to be the manager of your manager in a lot of those type of deals. And if not, you're going to come back in a few months and just have this expectation that they did a good job, when unfortunately you'll realize very fast that they're not as on top of it as yourself. But even more than that, in some ways, their incentives don't align with yours. And therefore, upcharging someone on maintenance, if you don't really have a really trustworthy manager, upcharging on maintenance is where they make their money. Putting in new tenants is where they make their money, because they'll get some sort of fee for a lease renewal, or they'll get, I don't know, 5 to 10% or 3% of the in-place rent, but they'll make more on a new unit turn because then they charge you for maintenance and they're putting in a new tenant. Now, not every manager is doing this, but I've seen this with managers. And to your point, when it's one complex, you could hire an employee and then you could let it go, and you don't have to hire a management company. As much as scattered site, small 20 units, 10 units, 5 units, you're gonna have to hire someone, especially if you have a full-time job. And that's where I'm seeing a lot of the trending issues that come up in today's market.
Yeah, well, look, there's plenty of property managers that I know that are excellent and extremely professional. It kind of
Correct.
goes to how I started this whole thing out, right? If you're not working with a group of people that are like-minded and are trustworthy, if they're putting their own interests before yours, or if you believe that they're always going to put your interests first, that's also as naive. But you have to work with the right people. I think I'm making a slightly different point. It's okay to buy and use a property manager. I think that's okay. I think you probably agree with that as well. The question is, what's the value proposition relative to what you could get by buying it in the market? So, in other words, if I had if I did it myself, and let's just say, for argument's sake, I could believe that I'll get 100% occupancy, right, at the highest rents. But if I hire a third-party management, they're not going to be nearly as good, and they're going to be at 97%, 96%, whatever the number is, right? That's a cost. You can measure that and you can say how much money you lost. Now take that, multiply by the number of units in the building. Great. What are you doing with that extra time? If that extra time is doing nothing, then you might as well manage it yourself. If you could say, well, with that extra time, I now bought another building or I did something else that was more valuable, right? Then you're better off using that third-party management. The failures I find in using third-party management fall generally into two categories. Number one, you're not staying on top of them, right? So that's obvious, and that's true for everything else. The second problem is that, and this is a general problem in real estate, where people are not focused on one area of expertise. So one day they're buying a property in Maryland, the next month they're buying something in Texas, and then they're buying something else in a different state, and you're never learning about the market specifics for that area. So I have plenty of people, this goes back many years ago, I think it still happens today, but to less degree, where someone was buying a property in a, let's say in a Baltimore area and saying, oh, I'm coming from a New York market. I've always been successful. Historically, New York was like a 98% occupancy and economic occupancy as well. And expense ratios were this, and this is how the court system worked, et cetera. If I just applied it to those idiots who are doing, who own something, like, I don't get it. Why is the cap rate in Baltimore this? Why are they at 94%, 92%? Why are they, oh, all I have to do is apply the New York method there and I'm going to do well. Most of those people found out that they did not do as well as they should. They didn't understand the market as well. And if you're bouncing around from market to market to market, and you never can learn enough about that particular area, and again, it makes a difference. You have short-term, long-term aspirations on a particular thing. Anyone can get away with something short-term, but if you're not going to learn about it in one area, then it's using a third-party management will probably just compound the issue.
Right. And to your point, I think we're going to see an increase in ownership groups looking to get out of state, especially with what we're seeing in New York specifically right now. I know from just mine on a brokerage level, we're seeing an increase of buyer interest from specifically New York that are looking to diversify in other states. And you really need to understand the market, because even though Baltimore is a lot easier when it comes to the regulations in comparison to DC, some of the other counties, New York, probably New Jersey. If you don't understand the way that the tenants work in this market, then you hand it off to someone else and are not on top of it. Those are all serious recipe for disasters. And that could lead to what we're seeing today. And this is really leading into my next question that, you know, I know you did the management side when you were with Greystone initially, or you only got into sales
No,
once you
I was
joined.
in general management. I managed operations and sales teams, but I was not in asset management or doing any management in that regard, just normal corporate management.
Got it, got it. What year did you switch from the corporate management to actual sales?
It was about 10 years ago. I think I started in 15 or so. It was soon thereafter, and Steve Rosenberg, who's the head of our company, and very smart person, wonderful, mentor, and very, very capable type of personality, came to me one day and he said, "I think you should go into sales, and I think that you'll do quite well." And I said, "Look, Steve, I'm like 42, 43 years old. I've always done management. I don't know what you're talking about." He goes, "Look, everyone's a salesperson," which I think he, by the way, still believes still today. Everyone's a salesperson, but I think that you can provide something very unique for your clients that people will gravitate to you. And we talked about the pros and the cons. And he gave me an offer I couldn't refuse. He said, like, "Go into it. I'm so certain that you'll do well. I'll guarantee your first year's compensation, whatever it is you're making
Wow.
today. I'll guarantee you because I'm certain that you will do much better than that." And he goes, "I can always find other managers, but I can't always find people who can do what you do, which is connect to clients, understand their needs. Not just financially, but also understand the needs of how to manage a property and what's a good loan, what's a bad loan." And so I'm very grateful to him that he pushed me in that direction. It's, best decision of my career.
That's amazing. That's really amazing because, to your point, that uncertainty, especially at that time in general, like in our world, if you're working, you're supporting a family, you're supporting your house, your education. There's a lot of expenses that come with it. And to just, it's easy when you're single to jump into sales. You're staying at your mom's place, your father, your dad's, your parents, whatever it is. Even if you're sharing an apartment with friends, fine, $500,000 a month is pretty much what your expenses are. But wow. And then so, did the, as we say, did the cat catch the mouse? How was your first year in sales?
You want to hear it? This is an amazing story. So, the gestation period of trying to get something done when you move into sales and the mortgages side, and maybe it's the same in investment sales, it could take 6 to 9 months before you finally catch your first fish, right? Anyway, so sure enough, I was on that trajectory. I had, at the time, by the way, I found a niche that nobody else was focused on, which was the broker model, both for mortgage brokers and for investment sales. And I realized that nobody could talk to them in the way that they needed to understand. There's this bank language and then there's broker language, and they're both in English, but they don't always mean the same thing. So I realized, that you can get to a very practical answer with certain brokers. That's what they want, in certainty of execution. So that was my focus. And I was dialing for dollars, and one day, but 7 or 8 months into it, with almost nothing to show for myself, a phone rang, and said, "Hi, my name is so and so." And I'm very careful, by the way, not to share private information, as you know. But so I have a client, he has a loan. The problem is that he has bankruptcy. I've had a hard time with other lenders being able to get approved. I've been at third base, and then they finally look into it, and then the deals die. I can't afford to do it. Do you think you can get over the issue? He told me what the problem was. The bankruptcy wasn't even real estate related. It was related to another business he owned, and I got it approved internally. And he said, he didn't tell me anything about the deal, location, or anything like that. And it turned out to be either a $50 or $60 million refi, which was being used to fund a $95 million acquisition,
Wow.
multifamily in New York. And that client ended up giving me a bunch of other business beyond that. But that's definitely from the hand of God. So my first year, I crushed it. I didn't crush it. Sorry, let me give credit where credit is due. I did my part. I made my phone calls, and God found the connection for me. And since that time, it's been very, very good. I have no complaints. It's been very, very, very successful, and I have very satisfied clients. I have a nice client base, both direct clients and also brokers. And no, obviously the last year and a bit has been kind of tough, but as you have with the Bible, I don't know what who your listeners are, but you have some fat years and you have some skinny years. I'm still definitely very thankful for the fat years. I think they're going to start coming back, but the last year and a half has been kind of tough, I think, for all of us.
Right. It's funny, and I'll get to the next topic from what you were saying right after this. So, I think everyone has their like first sales story if they're in sales. And for me, to your point, I remember I was making phone calls my first day in sales. I call this investor. I was trying to sell a property on my first day. I call him and he says, "Block my number. Never talk to me. I want nothing to do with you." Just literally, you know those calls. You call someone and they're just like, "Okay, no problem." A few months later, okay, I don't know, month, whatever it was, the guy calls me back and he's like, "Actually, I saw this property and I want to buy it." And then he
Wow,
bought the property.
that's amazing.
And I sold him a few more assets after that. But to your point, like, we really have no idea where things will come from. And most owners that I personally work with, at some point when I call them, they basically either cursed me off the phone, they hung up on me, they had nothing to do with me. And you, to your point, you have to put in your effort. You have to just constantly put in your effort. And I think that's where you really reap results, just constantly putting in and giving value. But bouncing off of what you were saying, talking about the skinny years and some of those more generous years, getting into where we are today, you know, coming from COVID, post-COVID, 21, where everything was going crazy, 22, 23, and now things are seemingly starting to slow down. I think what's on everyone's mind is, first of all, how is it that some of these servicers, without getting into names to your point, had so much problems, specifically when we look at, you know, Fannie blacklisting some of them and having them buy back some loans? Like, what was it that had certain, even private banks in general, look at the DSCR, you know, Wall Street market. What, in your opinion, led to, I should say, underwriters either making the wrong decisions or maybe underestimating? Like, you know, you're seeing this on your end. What do you think led to what we're seeing today, where Fannie is saying that there's a lot of fraud on their books?
Yeah, so, okay, I'm going to be careful. I'm going to slow down with what I say because there's obviously a lot to unpack there. And there's no one answer that'll satisfy the question. So let's start with this. I had no problems with fraud with any of my clients. And I closed hundreds of loans. That doesn't mean that I don't have clients who've given back properties. And it doesn't mean that I haven't had clients that have been accused of fraud. But I think your assumption that what was the mistake that appraisers or underwriters made is probably a little bit off. In other words, the Freddie Fannie system historically has always been an honor system. So, opposed to a bank that relies primarily on an appraiser for all of its analysis, both on value and the part that most people don't realize is the expense ratios. The agencies work primarily on an honor system. So if somebody provides a rent roll and a T12, it's assumed to be 100% accurate, right? If there's someone says that I bought this property for X dollars, it was assumed to be arm's length and honest. I think that you have to separate blacklists into two different, at least in two different categories. There's people who absolutely committed fraud, right? And so if somebody took a rent roll that just didn't exist, had 30, 40% vacancy and filled it up. Or they had tenants that were there and they were supposed to, the actual rent was X and they marked it down as X plus. There's no way, and then they created the associated leases to support that information. There is no real good way to prove that is false. And so when they made the loans at that time, there was no reason to assume that it would have been fraud. I think there you can now, looking back, I think there's a better way of analyzing that. They're pulling up information from historicals, like we've seen this property before. And that's where actually that's how this whole thing started. Freddie Mac, I think it was Freddie Mac, saw a loan from a on some from somebody who was trying to refi and had certain numbers, and then it didn't refi it and was sold 3 4 months later, or maybe reverse, and then the rent roll numbers for the exact same tenants and the exact same units all of a sudden was very different. And that was the needle in the haystack they were looking for, to just be able to pull the fire alarm and do the analysis. And then they got into everything. So, like, if somebody's a fraudster, they're a fraudster, and there's not much you could do about that. And, they got caught, and whatever happens to them happens to them. I think there's another set of people who are on the blacklist that is simple that, real estate has not done well. They bought with an assumption that properties would do better. Right. And all of a sudden interest rates went up. So all these floating rate loans all, went to bad debt service, or people were buying in other markets. Hey, you buy, it's kind of like the stock market for a while. It doesn't make a difference which stock you bought. You bought it for $10 a share and it was worth 13 3 days later, and you made money. As long as you were putting money in constantly, you were making money until the music stopped. Right. And so I think there's a lot of people who bought thinking that everything was so easy, and those people are now blacklisted, because if they gave back the properties to the agencies, by definition, even if there's no fraud, would you want to do business with somebody who you lost money with? Right. So that I think you have to separate between the two of them. And I don't think that they're looking for people who are causing who have been fraudulent. I don't think they're trying to purposely, uncover stuff and put everyone on the blacklist. They're being certainly more sensitive and careful than they were in the past. But, kind of what I said, or it'll come up over and over again. The best way to ensure that you're going to have a good loan is to understand the people you're doing business with and not focus solely on the financials of the property. That's important, but not nearly as important as sizing up something. I'm sure that you have this for yourself. You'll go to a property and you'll meet either a seller or a buyer and walk away with, like, something doesn't seem right here. And more often than not, you're right? Because your gut, if you're doing this long enough. So it's a matter of all the professionals in the room kind of saying, trying to steer towards good business opposed to bad business. And for me, actually, it's generated a lot more business and a lot more contacts for me, because people know that my approach is that way. And I don't like to miss my mark. I don't think it's fair to clients, especially people who are buying, that I tell them X dollars and then 3 days before the closing, you give them a different number. I don't mind for shooting for the stars, and sometimes it works out better than we expected. But you have to know the pros and the cons of everything, and be very honest with I was going to say with clients, but with everyone involved.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. And from there's really just two follow-ups. To your point about being upfront with people, I actually had a meeting earlier today before this episode, and I sat down with an investor that was ready to make an offer on a building I'm selling. And I said, "Listen, this is the information." I showed him the delinquency, I showed him everything, and I gave him a clear picture, and now he's doing his underwriting. But he told me, he's like, "Oh, I missed your delinquency sheet, and I was actually ready to offer a lot higher before then, but now I saw it, so I appreciate it. I'll get back to you," right? So to your point, I don't want that guy to buy the property if he didn't see that delinquency sheet, because I know he's going to come back to me in 4 months and have to sell it. And I rather build buyers that believe in my market, that succeed in my market, to buy more than the buyers that have to be repeat business because they failed, right? Because I think that and what we're seeing specifically in the market that I'm in, we're having a lot of bad press, right? And I know DSCR private banks may be slightly different than what you focus on with agency, but I do think that some of the clients that came into the market, had they had different advice, could have still bought the property, but been successful with it. And coming back to me today, instead of them needing to sell with me, they would actually be buying other properties. And unfortunately, I would say 70% of the sales we've done in the last year or two has been these sales with ownership groups that, unfortunately, whether it's because of management, the wrong underwriting, or whatever the reason is, got into it not understanding what they're doing. And that is really what causes me to ask that question, because I look at the underwriting and it doesn't make sense to me that agency, private, whoever it is, approved it, because you just run basic comps. These rents don't make any sense. You see what I'm saying?
Yes and no. I mean, it's, first of all, you have a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Which is, if one building is appraised at a certain value and it's getting a certain amount of rent. By definition, the next building that's appraised is going to use the first building as a comp. And then that drives the market, and then so on and so forth. And as I said before, at some point, the music sometimes stops, and then there's a reset, and that's natural in the marketplace. So, again, it's not that I don't believe that there's fraud. I'm just saying whether there's fraud or not, most clients are not dishonest people, and they're doing the right thing. Even to your point about the person about the delinquency, I not to tell you how to do your job. I'm sure that you said to him something along the lines that notwithstanding the delinquency, the value is still there and there's an opportunity. So if you get rid of those tenants and here's how you do it, you can create value. Now, even if he says, well, that's not my shtick. I don't want to do that. I'm looking for more of a turnkey. That's fine. You will find somebody else who finds value in that and may even appreciate their delinquencies because they like to evict and then renovate and get more money. So it's just about aligning it and having a client. I say it and I mean it. I'm very close to 100% client satisfaction because I'm very open and upfront with people. We could talk about how, try to get using your model, trying to get a concession out of the seller, how you could try to anticipate certain things. But, being upfront with people never, ever hurt me.
Right. And I think it leads a little bit into the next question, which is if someone's looking to buy an asset, where do you think in today's market Fannie and Freddie are looking to give the money to? Obviously, they're always looking, but sometimes they're leaning towards different asset types, different locations. What are you seeing based on what you're doing and where they're leaning with everything that's going on right now?
Okay, so I don't think you phrased the question probably correctly. There is no market that Freddie or Fannie won't lend to. In fact, the
Correct.
reason why they're in business is to ensure that there's liquidity in the market in every zip code across the country. So there's no places that they won't lend to. Do they lend at the same parameters in every single area? Obviously not. There are some markets that are stronger, there's some markets that are weaker. What I think people have to recognize is that when you do business with a bank, there's lots of lending options. There's life cos, there's CMBS, credit unions, et cetera, et cetera. But let's just limit the conversation to the two biggest ones, which tend to be, at least for our stuff, right? Banks and agency. The good and the bad in both of them is that a bank, there's a bank manager, there's somebody who's a loan officer that has a personality, that has a background, a history of a certain place, and is sizing things up. That works in your favor sometimes, where they say, all right, I'll do a deal in this area and I'll try to push for you. And it sometimes works against you. I always say, it's like, I woke up this morning, I had a fight with my wife before I went to work, so I don't want to do the deal. And I was like, what does that have to do with the deal? Nothing. I'm just not in the mood to go out of my way. I just don't, I was on the fence to begin with, and that moved me downwards. The agencies are much more logic-based. So they use statistics, they understand markets, they know which markets are softer, they know which markets are more aggressive, they recognize the risks that are associated with all of them. But it's very math driven. So knowing each market in advance is just a matter of fitting the property into the Freddie Fannie guidelines to understand where you're going to get for LTV and debt service. What I do think is very different is two parts. Number one, not every borrower should be borrowing from Freddie and Fannie, and not every property necessarily is a good Freddie Fannie mix. So they're much more concerned about property conditions today. So if you have a property that's got a lot of violations, it's not in great condition, not saying that you shouldn't go to Freddie and Fannie, but expect them to require you to improve the property. If that's your thing, I'm buying it for that reason. I think there's untapped value. I plan on upgrading this, that, and the other. I was going to get rid of these violations and do everything like that because I want my tenants to be happy, then that's a good fit. That's not a problem. If you're the type of person, I have a client who buys C properties in tertiary markets. The rents are $500 a unit. There's no way to keep that in pristine condition, right? That person should not be borrowing from Freddie and Fannie most of the time, not all the time. There's no all of anything, right? But he has to be prepared to reserve a certain amount of CapEx for that particular situation to be able to be okay with it. So that's that. The second thing is, not every borrower should be borrowing from the agencies. There's no question that the agencies require more from borrowers, more rent rolls, more financial statements. Although I just spoke to a client this morning who told me that most of the banks are starting to improve, increase that level anyways. But it, you don't have to take an agency loan, but if you take the agency loan, you need to be compliant and provide those reports. And so what I'll tell people, and you've heard me say this many times before, if you can get X dollars, let's pick a number, you can get $5 million from a bank at 5.75%, and I'm offering the same X at 5.75%, why would you come to me? Doesn't make sense. Now, if you care about the non-recourse
Non-recourse,
tax
yeah.
returns, you don't want to do the bank deposits. There's a variety of other things that that factor into it, no problem. But if you're going straight terms, why would you do it? Now, if I'm X plus 10% more, 5 million versus 5.5 million, and I'm a quarter of a point less, and I have more IO, don't just say send me the application and expect like, oh, it's the same as a bank, and I could just deal with it the same way. There's more of that's expected of you. The reason, and I'll reverse it, the reason Freddie and Fannie give more money is because they are more on top of things. So they're not abusive, they're not aggressive about it, they're clear about their intent up front. And I think historically, loan originators, maybe I was guilty of it as well somewhat. I don't think so, but it's possible. But I think a lot of loan originators in the agency space don't bother to tell that to the client. They're so, like, we're so flat, used to flashing dollars and rate around that we don't bother to tell everyone anything else about the asset management and so on and so forth. So these are, again, my examples. Right, go into Home Depot, you can buy a hammer, you can buy a screwdriver. They're both tools, but they're not used for the same job. So they may look the same, they may even have a similar cost, but you have to be able to apply, each tool for its appropriate use.
Right. And I appreciate that. I think that definitely gives clarity to a lot of different people out there. And it's something that I've been chirping about talking about regulation specifically with the product on Wall Street from Roth Capital, RCN, where to your point about fraud, kind of tying it into here, a lot of people were claiming that, Baltimore has fraud or Detroit or Chicago. And my personal take, which could be incorrect, is that there was some level of fraud, but I think mostly it was not the best underwriting done. If you're just looking at taxes and insurance and nothing else, you're leaving yourself open for a lot of problems. And I think that, to your point, it's a product, and if people want it, it's easier to get it. But you need to know what product you're taking, right? So, yes, agency, in most cases, is assumable, non-recourse, but you have to do your quarterly reporting or annual reporting, depending on where you're holding. And you It is a lot more tedious in comparison to a private bank, but private bank's recourse. So it's really just having that trade-off, but also knowing what you're doing. And based on all that, from what you're seeing in today's market, not predictions to be held to, but more just in general, how are you seeing things progress? Obviously, it's right now it's slow, but are you seeing ownerships that are actively looking for distressed assets to turn over? Or do you think, in general, right now, most ownership groups are sitting on the sideline? And really, just based on the activity you see from the loans you're doing, what's your expectation coming into this coming year?
So, as you know, with the agencies, it's based on stable rent rolls and stable income and expenses. So, there are definitely, I think there's groups that are doing everything, right? So, but if there are groups out there that are looking at buying distressed properties with where there's a vacancy issue, there's collection issues, whatever it may be, those generally don't go agency. It's not that it can't be done, it's just that you'll probably get better terms from either a bridge lender or from a bank that'll look more to where the future is rather than historical. So I know that exists. I've seen the deals, and more often than not, I'll just recommend to my client that they go elsewhere. Not that I don't want to do the business, but I just don't think it's the right tool, right? As far as stable buildings are concerned, again, as I said before, the agencies are very data driven, so they're still giving in many markets 80%. They're still on the on some loans doing 120 debt cover. I hope my phone doesn't start ringing that everyone starts thinking that every deal could be done at 80% and 120. We still live in a high interest rate environment, and I don't think that's going to get significantly better for another 4 to 6 months. So most deals are debt service constrained on the cash flow. And so the only advantage is that we have better pricing for loans that are either under 70 or 65% or even under 75%. So there are a lot of good opportunities. I think also there's more clients today. It used to be, just a buy the loan, refinance, buy the loan, buy a property, refinance, buy a property, refinance. And so 5-year deals with step down was very popular. I think that unfortunately the last few years have been so difficult for clients. Clients who could have taken 10-year money at 3% and elect to take 5-year money. And the idea of that they wanted to shorten prepayment period because I'm sure that this gravy train will never end, are regretting it. And so there's more clients who are looking for stable, look, this is what I'm going to be paying for the next 7 or 10 years. And so that's my game plan. I don't make more money, by the way, whether or not someone buys a 5, a 7, or a 10. I show everyone the options, whatever it is that they want. But I definitely see a lot more activity. I think the small loan market is still not as aggressive as it could be. We're hoping that, Freddie Mac, who's been on the sideline with their strongest product is the SBL product. Sorry, let me rephrase that. On the small side, their SBL product tends to be more aggressive than the Fannie Mae one. Their conventional oftentimes is better than the Fannie conventional, sometimes less, depends on the circumstance. But they've been on the sidelines because they've been trying to just get a hold of that portfolio. We're expecting that the pricing will come down, but it has not come down yet. Maybe in February it will. That's typically annually when they start to get more aggressive and they try to win some business. But we'll see. We'll wait and see. And I let my clients know through my newsletters or whatever it is when that happens.
Awesome. I don't know if you believe it or not, but we're already 50 minutes in a blink.
Oh, yeah. All right. That's great. Well, I'm
Yeah.
enjoying the conversation. So
It's good
you can do this as
stuff.
long as you would like.
So, really jump piggybacking off of that, in 2000, so you started 2015, which means that when you started working with debt brokerage, it was, I guess, already pretty much outside of the 2008 struggles that happened. I was going to ask, how do you see today in comparison to that? Although you were in the business, not necessarily the debt side of things, but how do you see it
No,
recovering maybe
I was
differently?
the, I, that's when I bought, by the way, the 2008. That's
Right.
so I'm very familiar. I just was looking at it from a perspective of an unfortunate owner rather than something else. But yeah, so I think it's very different. I think that the reason why there was a downturn the last time is that the valuations just made no sense. It was very easy to get money. That was around the same time as, no loan docs on the residential side. And there was just so much free money in the market that everyone was buying. And then all of a sudden it just stopped. I think the last few years, all this conversation about the fraud that exists in the Freddie Fannie, yeah, it's true, but I don't think that was actually the main reason. I think the main reason why we're having problems. Well, okay, let me say it this way. Fraud is oftentimes undetected when the outcome is that you sold the property and made a profit to someone else, right? So the fact that I did something wrong, as long as I could get out before it gets caught,
Flies under the radar.
right? So it flies under the radar. I think what happened, and forget the fraud again, I don't want to talk about that. It's a small percentage that's made the most noise, but that's not really the reality. Most clients, again, I'll say it because I think it's so important. Most borrowers and most property owners are good, honest people. And that they've been painted, unfortunately, with a bad paintbrush. Same thing with brokers. I think that that's also been a little bit overdone. There's plenty of good brokers that I have value as my friends, as people that I'm very happy to do business with, and I would stand up in the court of law or anywhere else and defend them. But the biggest problem that we've had over the last few years has been inflation. And so inflation caused the interest rates to go up. It caused the market to slow down probably longer than it needed to. I think that the current issues on inflation are much better, but now there's a slightly different issue, which is the massive ICE, deportation project that the Trump administration is going through. So there's different markets where there's now a lot more softness that rents are going down. So that's been going on for a bit. There's more people who have self-deported than the people who've been caught, and it's a significant number. So I think there's a number of different things. In New York, obviously, you have a mayoral issue that there's a lot of concerns about how that will affect the marketplace. But there's plenty of positive markets. For every time that there's something that goes down, there's something that goes up. And so it's just a matter of being very honest about it. I try to just be a tool for my clients, not to, there's an opportunity, find out business-wise, should you buy that property? Should you sell the property? What do you want to do for your business? Now, if you want financing, or if you're selling it and you want financing as part of that contingency, I can come in and provide you with a Freddie Fannie, and we didn't talk about it, FHA, but or a HUD loan, right? I'll provide you with that, and that hopefully that will help you achieve your ultimate goals. But if your goals don't align with the product that I'm selling, then find something else to align yourself with on the financial side. Sometimes it's just not for today, and sometimes it's for tomorrow.
Right. And to your point, Fannie, Freddie, today they're really looking at stable assets. And it seems to me, again, I think everyone works within their bubble. So the statistics that I may know might just be, again, from the bubble that I'm looking out of. And I think the question that some people have is, I know Fannie obviously has the system that they work with, but when it comes to a lot of those deals that are currently not in the condition that Fannie and Freddie want them to be in. And at least the deals that I do, I see that being an increasing problem. What typically is their strategy aside from trying to force some sort of sale or foreclosure and escrow payments? Now that that's increasing, do you see, I know it's different than sales, but are you seeing them trying to strategically figure out what to do with those assets?
Well, actually, I think you're misinformed. They're not trying to foreclose on anyone. So that's not okay.
Not
Most,
foreclosed,
but
correct.
let's say it like this.
Yeah.
For the vast majority of situations, if a borrower is paying their mortgage timely, whether or not they're getting harassed or bothered by violations, repairs, property conditions, a foreclosure will typically not begin. Okay. As far as I know, okay, that's not the issue. Will you get precluded from taking money out of an escrow account? Will you be forced to put up money into escrow to ensure that there's money available for a repair? Yes, that could happen depending on the severity of the property condition that's there. But they're not actively going out to foreclose. It's not what they want to do. It's not what they're interested in doing. I've had a lot of people who've gone into loss mitigation. Sometimes that's the best thing for them. Going into loss mitigation, there's now somebody who's trying to help them figure out their problem. What Freddie and Fannie want is to make sure that the money that they've put out is safe, right? Every lender wants the exact same thing. They want to get repaid, and they want to make sure that the asset that they have as collateral is valued at least to the level of the loan amount or better. But I have plenty of people who have below 1.0 debt cover, and they're not getting foreclosed on, and they're not even in orange. Well, maybe they're in orange status, which is a watch list, but not necessarily dealing with any problems. So, and I think you have to look at it more in totality and imagine for a moment. I tell my clients to just switch roles for a moment. If they were the ones who were lending money and I was the one borrowing, if I was, Freddie Fannie was on the opposite side, how would you want your money protected? And that's a good way to view your relationship with Freddie and Fannie. They're not bad people, but definitely they want their properties run decently. I'm not even going to say perfectly. They need to be run decently. They recognize that there's A, B, and C properties in different areas, and you just have to align their interests and your interests, and it can be very, very successful.
Right.
You've heard me say this also. I mean, plenty of people I've talked to, a number of people have left Greystone and I've taken over portfolios and I've called them and like, oh, I'm having this issue, that, da, 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 da. I would never. And then they're like, really? You can get me those proceeds? You can get me that rate? Yeah, so send me an application. And I'm like, I don't understand. 2 seconds ago, you were, it's like because they do still offer fantastic loans, but they are being a little bit more careful about who they're lending to and that you just need to be a better partner. And if you want less hassle, then go to a bank. And I'm not saying that in a negative way. I'm saying it's a different tool.
Practically.
Yeah, practically go to someone else who might, bother you less, but you're going to get less. That's just the nature of life, and you get more, you're expected to give more typically.
Right. Right. And I really appreciate coming on to the podcast, going through everything. And like I always do before we finish, was there anything else, last thoughts that you wanted to share based on what you're seeing or and just in general?
Nope, I think we covered absolutely everything. It's really a pleasure to work with you, and I appreciate the opportunity to come on here. Part of my job is obviously, the financial side is to make a living is selling loans. But that doesn't provide me with a tremendous amount of daily satisfaction. Go put my head down on the pillow at the end of night and say, oh, I closed this many loans. That's great. I'm not going to complain about it. And my wife and kids certainly like the goodies that come along with it, as do I. But working with clients, making sure that they're happy, trying to resolve issues, whether they're asset management or coming up with a good solution. And oftentimes the best satisfaction is telling the client that not now or not me. I feel good about that. And I know that there'll be another day where I can do something else with them. And that's the best. I have no regrets with what I'm doing. It's been a tough couple of years in the industry in general, even in the best of times has its challenges. But working with people like you and your clients is the it makes it all worthwhile.
Beautiful. I really, really appreciate having you on. If anyone has stable assets, you want more information about Greystone and about what they could do for you, feel free to reach out to Avram. Avram, what's your email?
It's avram.foreman@grayco.com, Grey. So it's Avram, Avrom, dot Foreman.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for coming on. And everyone, until the next episode, I hope you are successful with your real estate endeavors.